It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The New Hampshire State House this year has seen a lot of reruns from last year. Bills that were brought up and defeated are being brought up again with hopes for a different outcome. And one of the most controversial of those is what's known as right-to-work legislation, which seeks to change how unions operate in the workplace. Right-to-work prohibits organized labor from forcing anyone to join a union and bars collecting dues from non-union members. Labor leaders say this is unfair because those non-union workers are still protected by collective bargaining agreements and that the real goal of right-to-work is to weaken unions. Meanwhile, supporters of these bills cite dozens of studies showing how much better off economically right-to-work states are in terms of jobs, personal income, attracting new businesses, and so forth. In New Hampshire, a right-to-work bill passed the legislature last year, but Governor Lynch vetoed it, and the override attempt lost by 13 votes. Last week, a hearing on the latest version of the bill packed Representatives Hall. A vote could be months away, however, as both sides jockey to line up support in hopes of victory. Today in The Exchange, we look at the right-to-work debate nationally and how these arguments will be heard in New Hampshire in the months ahead. Let's hear from you two this hour. What do you think? Is right to work right for New Hampshire? Would it lead to more job creation, more companies coming here? Or is it not needed in the Granite State, a state that's already doing pretty well economically compared to many other states? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests with me in studio is Gordon Lafer. He's an associate professor at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. And Gordon, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here.
Also with us from the D.C. area, Stan Greer, newsletter editor for the National Right to Work Committee. He also writes and does research for the National Institute for Labor Relations Research. That's an educational affiliate of the Right to Work Committee. And Stan, good to have you, too. Thanks for your time.
I'm glad to be here with you.
And joining us from Chicago, Mark Guarino. He's staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. He's based in Chicago, but he's been covering the right to work battles across the Midwest. And Mark, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.
Well, and Mark, I want to start with you. Could we just first define this thing? I mean, supporters call these bills right to work. Opponents say that's a misnomer. What does a right to work law do?
Well, the right to work law, it talks about the contracts between the employer and the unions, and it mandates that all workers in those contracts, involved in those contracts, must pay union dues. So as you said in your earlier introduction, supporters say the law will help attract new business to the state, but the opponents are calling it an attempt to weaken organized labor. So that's really the divide here of the purpose of enacting that law. And both sides, you know, often in these debates bring out studies that show that really help their case, but they're always conflicting. And it really comes down to a debate really over the purpose of union membership in the state.
Well, and Mark, 23 states now have right-to-work laws. You covered the latest battle in Indiana. From state to state, do these laws vary, Mark, or are they pretty much the same model in each state?
The model is very similar. The most recent one, the reason that right-to-work really kind of, you know, we started 2012 hearing about it in the news because Indiana became the latest state to pass the law. It was a very contentious battle to have that happen. In last year, the House Democrats left for 5 weeks to prevent a quorum to have that vote being passed through. It happened this year, and it's because it's a national presidential year that it's becoming much more of an issue because the opponents to the law are saying that it's weakening union membership, which is going to affect Democrats nationally.
So, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that and then bring our other guests into it, too. But, Mark, have we been seeing more right-to-work bills coming up in states across the country this year and perhaps at the end of last year?
We have, yeah. And we also, it's kind of been wrapped up in a larger movement involving unions across the country, particularly in the Midwest. Most people know about what's been happening in Wisconsin. There's a collective bargaining bill that was a very contentious battle there earlier last year. And that fight is continuing a year later, involving the recall of the governor there. The governor of Ohio passed a similar bill, but it was rescinded by voters late last year. The governors of Michigan first indicated that he wanted to go forward with a right to work bill, but just recently said he's going to put that off. And so it's been popping up in a lot of states where manufacturing is very high and union membership is also pretty high as well.
So again, just to be crystal clear, Mark, in a right-to-work state, unionized workplaces cannot say to someone, you have to be in the union. That person has a choice. And they also can't say, okay, look, you have to pay at least a portion of union dues because you're covered by this collective bargain agreement. They can't do that either. That's the basis of a right-to-work law. Is that correct?
That's correct, right.
All right.
And you know, so union members, workers have the choice whether to join the union or not. It's just a matter of whether they're going to get the full rights of, you know, with coming with the dues.
Well, and I want to bring Gordon Lafer and Stan Greer into this, too. And Gordon, to you first, you know, Mark told us about this renewed push around the country, especially in his area, the Midwest, to get more right-to-work laws on the books. What do you think's behind this renewed push?
Well, first, I just want to clarify a bit. Right to work is not about anybody being forced to be a union member or to pay dues to political causes they don't support, because federal law already says that nobody can be required to be a member of a union or pay dues to any political causes they don't like. What right to work does is it makes it illegal for employees and employers to negotiate a contract that includes a requirement that says everybody that benefits from the terms of a union contract has to pay their fair share of the costs of administering and negotiating it, which is just a little different from what was said. The idea of right to work historically, and this is from the proponents, has been that by weakening unions, you lower wages and benefits in a state and therefore make it more attractive to outside manufacturers to bring them in. And again, this is what the proponent says. The Chamber of Commerce says unions, quote, increase labor costs and make a state less attractive for investors. Here in New Hampshire, one of the main promoters of right to work says unions demand higher wages, so right to work would provide companies more cost-effective opportunities. So the idea is by weakening unions, you bring down wages and benefits and attract outside manufacturers. The problem is that it doesn't work. What the statistical studies show, and I can explain later what's the difference between a scientific study and the kind of non-scientific numbers that are floating around, but what the real scientific studies show by independent academics across the country is that the impact of adopting a right-to-work law, all other things being equal and after controlling for different costs of living in the states, is to lower wages by about $1,500 a year for both union and non-union workers, to slightly lower the odds of getting health insurance or pension through your job, and to do nothing for job growth. And the reason it does nothing for job growth is because we live in a globalized economy. I'm sure it was true in the 1970s or 1980s that there were companies that left New England for the South or Southwest to get, for various reasons, including lower wages. But in 2012, companies that are looking for cheap labor overwhelmingly are going to China or Mexico. They're not going to South Carolina or Arizona. And in terms of that, the most important case, really the only important case for a state now debating right to work, is the case of Oklahoma. Except for Indiana last week, Oklahoma is the only state to have newly adopted right to work since NAFTA in the globalized economy. They did it in 2001.
Just in the early 90s.
And the debate in Oklahoma, if you read it, is almost word for word the same as things now being said in New Hampshire and elsewhere. People in Oklahoma were told that right to work would boost their manufacturing sector, and above all, they had site location consultants who came into the legislature and said, companies aren't coming here because you're not right to work. Oklahoma's being redlined. And if you go right to work, you will have an 8 to 10 times increase in the number of companies who come here. And they said, well, can you name the companies? No. Do you have any survey data? No. But, you know, we talk to a lot of people. Trust us. Well, now we have 10 years of data in Oklahoma. Oklahoma, manufacturing was supposed to go up. Instead, manufacturing is down by a third. The number of new companies coming into Oklahoma, which was promised to rise by 8 to 10 times, is instead down by 30% since Right to Work passed. And these are numbers from the Oklahoma Department of Commerce. They're not contested. Every promise made in Oklahoma turned out to prove false. And it makes sense when you think about the globalized economy. So what you have really is, I think, is something driven by anti-union ideology. And that's fine. People are, you know, entitled to whatever passions they have. But in terms of the economic facts, the result is to lower wages and benefits without doing anything to boost job growth. That's the problem.
Well, and Stan Greer, let's bring you into this. So does globalization change the arguments that we used to hear surrounding right to work? What do you think, Stan?
Let me start at the beginning, actually. Dr. Lafer really misrepresents the labor law, national labor policy that right to work laws are designed to correct. He says that federal labor law protects your right not to join a union, but it really doesn't protect it in a meaningful way. Let's look at what would happen if the shoe were on the other foot. If federal labor law protected your right to join a union over an employer's objection, but federal law allowed the employer to prevent you from paying dues to that union that you joined, would you really have a right to join a union? No, you would not have a genuine right to join a union. And similarly, if federal law says you have a right not to join a union, but you can be forced to pay fees that can be just as high as dues to the union, then you really don't have a right not to join a union. So Dr. Lafer is playing semantics here to try to make the federal policy sound more respectful of individual liberty than it is. It isn't.
What about the economic arguments? I think that's the heart of what we've been hearing here in New Hampshire.
I totally disagree that it is the heart of what we're discussing. The heart of what we're discussing is individual liberty. I can address the economic arguments, but the fundamental issue at stake in right-to-work laws, contrary to what people like Dr. Lafer would have you believe, is whether or not federal policy should provide equal protection for the right to join and the right not to join a union, and whether state policy should provide equal protection for those two things. It's not, primarily a job attraction tool. Now, the so-called facts that he states about Oklahoma are totally false. If you look at the actual Department of Commerce data from 2003, which is the proper year for looking at the start of the impact of the Oklahoma Right to Work Law, because although it was enacted in 2001, it was held up in court by organized labor for 2 years and not upheld by the state Supreme Court until the end of 2003. You look at the trend from 2003 to 2010, it's true that manufacturing employment has declined in Oklahoma, as it has in 49 of the 50 states, but its decline in Oklahoma was more in the order of 11%, not a third, like Dr. Lafer says. I don't know where that number comes from.
Okay, and Stan Grier, I'll let you finish up your point for sure after a short break, and we'll tease out some of these economic arguments, look at how they may play out here in the Granite State, and hear from you at 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 919, and support for NHPR comes from your members and from Heritage Plumbing and Heating Cooling for any plumbing, heating, cooling, or drain problem. Offering annual tune-ups and efficient heating systems online at justcallheritage.com. And from Woodstock Inn, Station, and Brewery, 33 rooms and 2 restaurants under one roof, offering its spirited wassail ale, a winter warmer for après-ski. WoodstockInnBrewery.com. More on is Right to Work, Right for New Hampshire on the Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, Counterfeit Prescription Drugs. New Hampshire weather for today, clouding up with showers possible by evening. Highs today from 40 in northern parts of the state, ranging to 50 in southern sections. Tonight, cloudy, occasional rain mixing with some wet snow over the White Mountains and parts of northern New Hampshire. Lows tonight from 25 to 30 north, ranging to around 35 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at national efforts to pass right-to-work legislation and how the arguments we're hearing nationally may be heard here in New Hampshire as well, as New Hampshire looks once again at right-to-work. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. Do you think right-to-work is right for New Hampshire? Would it lead to more job creation, more companies coming here? Or would it depress wages in a state that's already doing pretty well economically? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange at nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so you can go to our page and join the conversation there. And Stan Grier, sorry I had to cut you off. We were heading into the break. Go ahead and finish up your point. You were countering what Gordon Lafer said, that Oklahoma has done poorly since it passed right to work 10 years ago. You're saying not so. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm saying that actually, if you look at the actual data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which is that provides the broadest measure that I'm aware of private sector employment trends in the 50 states, in this 7 years from 2003 to 2010, 2010 being the last for which annual data are available, private sector employment in Oklahoma went up by a little bit over 8%, which is more than triple the private sector employment growth in non-right-to-work states as a group, and about 60% greater than the private sector employment growth in the neighboring non-right-to-work states around Oklahoma. So he totally misrepresents what's happened in Oklahoma since the law passed. And you know, it's interesting that at the time that the Oklahoma bill, right-to-work bill, was being debated, the Economic Policy Institute, which is one of the organizations, you didn't mention it, but Gordon Lafer is a research associate for the Economic Policy Institute, which is a think tank funded by organized labor largely that devotes a lot of its attention to opposing right-to-work laws. And at the time that the Oklahoma law was being debated, the Economic Policy Institute predicted that if a right-to-work law passed in Oklahoma, 112,000 Oklahomans would lose their health insurance, a very specific prediction. If you look at what's actually happened since 2003, when the law was upheld by the state Supreme Court, the number of people covered by private employment-based health insurance in Oklahoma has gone up by 7.6% compared to a decline of 6.5%.
So benefits have gone up, basically, instead of going
down. The
number
of people covered by private employment-based health insurance has gone up in Oklahoma. It's gone down in non-right-to-work states nationwide by 6.5%.
Let me ask you guys another question, and I'm real curious about it. Maybe all three of you can jump in on this. You know, given the low level of unionization in this country, I mean, I think it's, I don't know, 10% in most states, maybe even a little bit lower here in New Hampshire. I wonder, and I'll turn to you first, I think, Mark, how much of a difference can right-to-work really make in terms of a state's economic success?
I mean, it's kind of what you're hearing already. It is a matter of debate. You know, different groups have different numbers they're putting out there, and it's you know, a lot of the argument kind of going into it really is about the job creation angle. However, we really haven't seen whether or not that's true, because there's so many other factors lending itself into that argument, especially now that we're in a recession, and it's we don't really, you know, it's not really the single issue determining job creation in the states that we've been looking at least, especially in the Midwest.
Yeah, I wonder that too, and I want to hear from both of you. Gordon Lafer, you first. So, if unions are such a small percentage of the workforce, how much does this really make a difference? Why are we getting all hot under the collar about this?
It makes a difference in lowering wages and benefits, which is what it's supposed to do. It makes no difference in job growth, neither negative nor positive. And let me just say, I know what it's like to listen to a debate where you have different numbers on different sides and listeners feel like, you know, I'm going to turn this off because who can tell? There is a way to tell between a bogus number and a scientific number. And this is a statistical method. This is the thing which distinguishes between any number that would get published in an academic journal, any number that would be accepted in a court of law as admissible evidence instead of junk science, which is kind of exactly what Mark Guarino was saying. When you think of all the different things that affect a state's economic growth, there are hundreds of different policies, hundreds of different natural features. You say, okay, Texas versus Michigan. Texas grew faster, but is it because it has warm weather or it has oil or it has immigration from Mexico? What you need to do is to do the statistical work to hold everything else equal so you can focus in on the thing we really want to know, which is what is the impact of this one policy, all other things being equal? And when you do the research that way, for instance, when I said it lowers wages by $1,500 a year, that's a study that controlled for 42 different factors. The numbers that Mr. Greer, but also other right-to-work proponents put forth when they just say, look at this state versus this state, or these 22 states versus these 28 states, are meaningless in terms of policy analysis because they don't control for anything. And so you have no idea what drives that. All the studies that have been done that really control for things by academics across the country find that it slightly lowers wages and benefits and has no impact on job growth.
Well, and Stan, I want to get you on this too, but here's my question for you, Gordon.
Yes.
You know, again, given low levels of unionization here in New Hampshire, if right to work were to pass in New Hampshire, how would that lower my wages working here at NHPR?
Well, when you have unions have a significant presence in an industry, it has a spillover effect to non-union workers. For instance, where I work at the University of Oregon, it's a town of 200,000 people, and the biggest employer is the university and a hospital where the employees are unionized. So if a secretary at the University of Oregon gets health insurance because of her union contract, it increases pressure on the non-union employers in the area if they want a good secretary, not necessarily to match the union contract, but to move up towards that level. And so by contrast, when unions are undermined by right-to-work laws, if union standards reduce, it also has a spillover effect that everybody else's wages and benefits also are weakened.
Even though know the percentage of unionized workers
well,
in today's
obviously,
labor force is very small.
In places where unionization is higher, the effect is greater, and where it's smaller, it's less. Yeah.
Stan, what do you think about that?
Well, what Gordon Lafer is doing is he's saying that he has models that show what the impact of right-to-work law is, and they don't require any
data.
Confirmation by real-world experience.
It's absolutely
real-world. We just know that they're true. So, for example, the EPI, using its very scientific methodology, the same methodology that Gordon Lafer is using today, and it was an EPI study, a study by a union-funded think tank that came up with the number on wages that he keeps citing, and I asked them for what the 42 factors are. I personally
this is trying
them,
to compare
what
states,
are the 42
states
factors they are?
They're
published. They're using to adjust wages and benefits, and they wouldn't tell me. So it's a mystery meat. Who knows how they
Stan,
how they get
can
the results?
You can you please address my question, which is, given low levels of unionization in this country, why is everybody again so hot under the collar about right to work? Why does this matter so much?
Well, for us, of course, as I've been saying, it's a matter of principle, and it wouldn't matter if how many workers' rights are trampled by being forced to financially support an organization they would never voluntarily join. So that's the biggest reason for me. But one reason why unions have a much bigger impact on a state economy than you might expect given their numbers is that it's based in the compulsory dues and fees that we're talking about. So the LM2 forms that most private sector unions of any size are required to file with the federal government.
What's LM2?
It's a kind of disclosure form. I think I don't know if it stands for labor management, but it's a kind of disclosure form that unions are required to file since 1959 under the Landrum-Griffin Act, showing things about the revenue and their assets and all that. And if you examine LM2 forms collectively, then unions that file such forms altogether spent $1.1 billion on politics and lobbying in the 2009-2010 election cycle. So they put that is a big chunk of money in politics. This is self-reported numbers coming from the unions themselves.
I see what you're saying. So you're saying it's not fair for people who don't support the union or its political ideology to put their money, to have their money taken towards political causes.
Well, that's not all I'm saying. I think it's unfair to force people to pay dues for
a
bargaining they don't support and may well be contrary to their interests as well. And I can talk about how it often is contrary to their economic interest. But the reason that frankly, the EPI cares so much about this and people who are allied with organized labor on political issues care so much about this is they know that organized labor is a very major player in federal, state, and local politics, and the power to collect compulsory dues and fees is a big part of that. And, of course, the policies that organized labor lobbies for with all that money are policies that, of higher taxes, more regulation that have an impact on growth as well as labor policy. So when people like Dr. Lafer say, well, you have to take out tax policy, you have to take out regulatory policy in deciding whether right to work has an impact, that's very misguided. Because
all right, I want to get our listeners in on this too. Lots of folks who want to jump in on our conversation on the phone or by email. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And David's been waiting in Goffstown. Hi, David. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I recently moved here from Arkansas, which is a right to work state. I moved here because it wasn't a right-to-work state. I lived in a right-to-work state that had plenty of jobs. They just weren't paying a living wage. I'm making approximately $7 to $8 an hour more now doing the same job that I could not find a job in Arkansas doing for nothing that I could live on. My wife moved with me here, and she's experienced the same thing. The wages are much better here than they are in Arkansas. There are jobs. in Arkansas, there's just no paying jobs in Arkansas.
Well, they pay, but not very much. Is that what you're saying, David?
Exactly.
Well, welcome to the Granite State, and thanks for calling in. Have you heard this argument before, Mark, from the Christian Science Monitor, that wages differ greatly between right-to-work states and non-right-to-work states?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a bedrock of the opposition to right to work, especially the Indiana fight. And I wanted to kind of backtrack just one step. You know, there's the talk about individual liberty being affected by, as a reason to have right to work in the states. That really wasn't. I mean, that's more of a recent argument, and that really didn't really enter the dialogue in Indiana. Really, the debate in Indiana really came down to an economic one between those who felt there was a job creator and those who felt that it, like your caller, it brought down wages. And both sides really brought out a lot of anecdotal evidence to show it. And there was definitely data, but it wasn't necessarily a debate about individual liberty. It really came down to an economic snapshot, especially because Indiana's unemployment rate remains at about 9%. And the governor really wanted to say, hey, if we pass this, we're going to get a lot. I'm talking to a lot of companies who want to come here, but they don't want to come here and set up shop because we don't have this law yet. That's why we want to have this law. And critics really railed against the governor, saying that you're using anecdotal evidence. And, you're just saying, there's really no evidence that companies all of a sudden are going to pull the trigger. It's more just something that's kind of out there and out there in just the debate that went on in the long contentious. I mean, that was almost a year in terms of getting that bill passed.
There. All right. Well, David, thanks for that call. And our number 1-800-892-6477. Myron's calling from Deerfield. Hi, Myron. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, thank you. Good morning.
Sure.
I have 25 years of human resources experience, and I've worked in both unionized and non-union environments. And from an employer perspective, it is more expensive to operate in a unionized setting than non-unionized. And additionally, the risk is all borne by it's the employer that has to carry it.
So, Myron, do you think New Hampshire should become a right-to-work state? That would help boost our job base.
It would free up employers to expand instantly.
Okay. Myron, thanks a lot for calling. And I know this is an argument that you have argued against, Gordon Lafer.
Well, no, I actually think he's probably right. I mean,
really?
Not that right-to-work would expand jobs, but that it increases wages and benefits. I mean, we know nationally, on average, if you take two people working in the same industry with the same age and the same level of education, one has a union and one doesn't, the person with a union on average makes about 15% more in wages and has a 20 to 25% better chance of getting health insurance or pension through their job. So I understand employers, who may want to pay less, that's their right, but that doesn't necessarily make it good state policy. And I actually think, what that caller said is exactly what I think. There are employers who want to pay less, and they think right to work will enable them to do that, because what it does in a union, when somebody is a non-dues paying member, in a workplace covered by a union contract, says, I don't want to pay any dues, they never say, oh, and you can pay me the non-union scale in this industry. Plus, the union is required by federal law to provide all services to those people the same as any members, right? So it's like if you would say to me, the part of your taxes that go to pay for the fire department is now optional, but they'll still come to your house and put out the flames if you catch on fire. It's not that I don't value the fire department, but when it's the end of the month and I'm paying my bills and here comes one that's optional, a lot of people won't pay that.
But what you just said, Gordon, isn't that an argument for right to work? The idea that, yeah, it is attractive to companies because they can expand because they won't have to pay people quite so much.
No, because what turns out is I'll focus on manufacturing. Really, there's two, you can divide it in two ways. There's low-wage manufacturers I assume that all employers generally would like to pay less, but the low-wage manufacturers now who care about low wages overwhelmingly are going overseas. The high-wage, high-tech manufacturers, there's an annual survey put out by called the State New Economy Index, totally not political, it doesn't lobby anything, and they rank all the 50 states according to how favorable they are to high-tech, higher-wage employers, which is what every state is trying to recruit now, both because they pay better and they're less susceptible to going abroad. 9 of the top 10 states there are non-right to work, and New Hampshire is actually ranked 11th, which is ahead of all the right to work states except for Virginia. And that's because those companies are not looking to make their profit based on lower wages. They're saying we want highly educated people, we want good school systems, we want good research universities. And New Hampshire has a disproportionate share of high-tech manufacturers, including in the defense industry. I think that's one of the things that's made the state successful.
Well, and speaking of the state's success, and Myron, thanks again for that call. Stan, here's the argument against right to work in New Hampshire, that we are pretty successful. Our economy is doing far better than almost any other state. Low unemployment. Our social statistics are great. You know, great place to raise kid, healthy, wealthy. So the argument here, Stan, is look, let's not mess it up. We're doing fine.
Well, I don't want to trash New Hampshire or anything like that. But I think what you have to understand is that a large share of what's referred to as New Hampshire's success, and I'm talking especially of its low unemployment rate, is a result of the Ebenezer Scrooge effect. That is, you reduce the problem of unemployment by reducing the surplus population. So the census data show that over the last 10 years, the contrary to what the caller implied, that the 25 to 34-year-old population of New Hampshire has fallen by 10%, even as it rose by about 2% nationwide, and considerably more than that in right-to-work states as a group. So, and of course, that is the segment of the workforce that is most apt to be unemployed in the national downturn or even in good times. So if a person, you know, is so despairs of finding a job in New Hampshire that he leaves the state.
A young person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's no longer counted among the ranks of the unemployed. And in fact, the labor force growth in New Hampshire over the past dozen years or so is something in the order of 40% less than the average labor force growth in right-to-work states. And that is a very significant part of the reason why unemployment is relatively low in Oklahoma, in New Hampshire. And one should also call Dr. Lafer's attention to the fact that when you're looking at college-educated people age 25 and over alone, that there's a substantially faster overall increase in that population in the right-to-work states and the non-right-to-work states. Over the past decade, it's about a 35% increase versus a 25% increase in non-right-to-work states.
Well, and that brings up the geography of right-to-work, which I will ask you gentlemen about after a short break. And if you're on the line, stay there. We'll take your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477.
You might not realize that NPR and NHPR are separate organizations. NHPR pays NPR program fees to air some of your favorite shows.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Good Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is NPR.
We also carry programs from several different sources.
It comes to you from APM, American Public Media.
Welcome to Q on CBC Radio 1.
Shows produced at WXBN from the
United. And this is PRI.
The best radio programs from around the country and the world are right here on NHPR. Now you know.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, helping you create eco-friendly sleep environments. Also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. And from thelobbynh.com, the new online source for New Hampshire business and politics, found at thelobbynh.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we look at the latest proposed education funding amendment for New Hampshire. Email us your questions or comments before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning, live at 9 for that. Today, we're taking a national look at right-to-work legislation, given that it's being studied here in New Hampshire and that it's come up a lot around the country, including Indiana recently becoming the 23rd state to pass right-to-work. Join us with your comments and thoughts. Would right-to-work here in the Granite State lead to more job creation, more companies coming here, or would it depress wages in a state that is already doing, by most measures, pretty well? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, just before the break, we started to get into the interesting geography of right to work. And I think, Mark Guarino, I want to turn to you first. I know it's hard on the radio, but create a map for us, if you could, of right to work, where we see it and where we don't. And what might be behind those divisions we see on the map?
Well, you're seeing it mostly in the South and also in the West. And not, it's almost a real divide in the country. The Midwest, in a way, is sort of isolated. It is, it does exist in Iowa, but really up until Indiana, the Rust Belt was largely clear of the right to work. And in the upper Northeast, you don't see it at all either. You're seeing it more in states where manufacturing is a really significant part of the economic snapshot there. Whether it's going to move further into the Midwest is really up to debate. Essentially, one of the reasons is it's a real political risk, what we're seeing. The fight, the union fight in Wisconsin, really, I think, did affect the push, union pushes in other states in the Midwest. And one of the reasons why Indiana was susceptible to it is because union membership is the lowest in Indiana compared to its surrounding neighbors. So the Republican majority there felt it was their time to kind of push this through. Whereas in other states, especially, you're seeing in Michigan and Wisconsin, it would be much more of a political battle for that to happen. And that's really a key to right to work happening in states are the political risks of the people of what's going on at the time, the political momentum. So that's the effect there.
Well, and it was a big deal that it passed in Indiana, right, Mark? I mean, I kept seeing headlines, first in the Midwest and so forth.
Right. It did. And again, it was tied to this walkout that happened last year. All the, in Indiana, for bills to pass, you need to have a quorum of legislators present to actually have any bills pass. The Democrats kind of taking a cue of what they did in Wisconsin. Illinois sort of became a sanctuary for neighboring Democrats from both states. They went to Illinois for 5 weeks to prevent that from happening. It was dropped from the agenda. And then for this new session, added to the agenda. And again, they didn't leave the state, but they just didn't show up to have this bill passed. They wanted to go around the state to explain what right to work was. They felt it wasn't communicated enough to state residents to know what the effects on their side, what they felt right to work what would be. And then they wanted a referendum, as what happened in Ohio. They conceded both those, that both of those didn't happen, and it was passed. But not without a really contentious, again, like what we saw. Not the numbers didn't show up in Indianapolis as they did in Madison, Wisconsin. But again, it's one of the reasons is that union membership is lower than Indiana. Mm-hmm. So it's not as much of, and there's less of a progressive movement in Indiana. One of the reasons that, those on the side opposing to right to work really are against it, saying that, the unions in Indiana are really kind of the only progressive movement in Indiana. They're kind of the central to it, whereas in states like Wisconsin, they're a part of it, but they're not the central, sort of leading group of the progressive movement there.
Well,
so weakening the unions there would have real implications politically.
And before we go back to our phones, I did want to ask our other guests about the geography question. And Gordon, I'm going to ask it to you, but in a slightly different way. Much was made, as we heard from Mark, that Indiana was the first state in the Midwest to go right to work. The argument here in New Hampshire has been, hey, if we went for right to work, we'd be the only state in the Northeast, the only state in New England, making us a further standout for companies based in this region of the country. So they say that's a compelling argument for right to work.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it is really critical to use scientific evidence of what is happening in the economy, which again is not, I mean, Mr. Greer or other people can say, oh, Gordon Lay for this. I should be clear, I'm not paid by anybody to do any of this. And the same things I found have been found by multiple independent academics in other universities, which all show what I said, which is that it lowers wages and benefits without drawing companies into the state. I think it's important also, you know, this is being pushed across the country by the Chamber of Commerce, by the Koch brothers, by big money people nationally. They're pushing for it in every state. Every state they go to, they say, oh, you'll be the first. But they're pushing for a national law to make every state right to work. And I think one of the things that's important about New Hampshire, New Hampshire doesn't just have a lower unemployment rate than the right to work states, but by almost every economic measure you can come up with, New Hampshire has higher median income and lower poverty rate than all 22 of the right to work states. It has a higher rate of new business openings. It has, you know, if you look at life expectancy, infant mortality, education rate, hunger, the percentage of people who have health insurance, even violent crime, it's not only better than the average of all the right to work states, it's better than almost every single one. You know, I have no doubt that if there was a law that the right to work states could pass to say we want New Hampshire's economy, they'd pass it in a heartbeat. I mean, by all economic logic, they should be trying to become New Hampshire rather than saying, can New Hampshire become more like Mississippi or Alabama?
Can you address that geographic argument too, Stan, please?
Well, it's funny that, you know, Dr. Lafer says sometimes only the statistics that count are his economic models, but when there are, you know, just plain old statistics coming from the federal government that he finds convenient, he's eager to cite them. The fact is that other statistics coming from the federal government show that Bureau of Economic Analysis data I referred to a little bit ago show that private sector job growth in the right-to-work states as a group was a little over 10% over the past decade compared to 4% growth in New Hampshire alone and 2% growth in non-right-to-work states as a group. So it's not true that New Hampshire's economy is growing as fast as right-to-work states economy. He said that, you know.
But our unemployment rate is a lot better.
What?
Our unemployment rate is a lot
better. Your unemployment rate is a lot better, as I said, largely than most right-to-work states, largely because of the out-migration of young people. And I'll add that you know, you have a 10% decline in people 17 and under in New Hampshire over the past decade, even as the number was growing by 4% or so nationwide and by a lot more than that in the right to work states. So you know, you maintain that good unemployment rate by eating your future, basically. It's not really a way, it's nothing to brag about, and it's not a sustainable path for the state.
Let's take another call if we could, gentlemen. This is David waiting in Concord. And David, go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to address, well, we talked about concrete numbers that were used, and we just heard an argument presented that was outstanding in terms of how the growth in New Hampshire is staggering right here because of the loss of 17 to 25-year-olds. But there was a number thrown out earlier, $1.1 billion, that is used by the union that's thrown at a political campaign. And it seems, wow, that's a staggering number. But if we're going to compare the two sides here, can you throw at me the number that's used by corporations that are in favor of right to work, just so we can compare the two things? Because if you want to make $1.1 billion sound like a lot of money, please tell me the number that's used to fight in favor of right to work.
I'm sorry, Dave, didn't mean to cut you off there. Gordon, can you give us that?
I don't have that number, but I do know that in the 2010 federal elections, corporations outspent labor unions by 15 to 1 nationally.
That doesn't include the $1.1 billion.
And I'd be happy if Stan has that number to hear what it is.
Yeah, everybody's got money in the game, don't they, Stan?
That's not contributions. That's not PAC contributions. That's not and you know, when you use that 15 to 1 number, that's basically assuming that anybody who makes an individual, every contribution that comes from an individual who works for a business, who works for the private sector, not just an employer, but anybody who works
PAC
for a business is a
what it doesn't include
not
is
just
the super PAC,
contributions,
which
that is
not remotely true.
I'm sorry. Understand both of you when you guys are talking at the same time, and I'm trying real hard to give everybody an equal opportunity, but Stan, can you quickly finish that point, and Gordon, can you quickly jump in?
The $1.1 billion doesn't refer to PAC contributions, and it doesn't refer to individual contributions to candidates either. That comes from a separate fund. The $1.1 billion is union treasury money that, according to unions' own reports on their LM2 forms, so this is nothing we made up. We just added up what unions acknowledge spending on their LM2 forms.
Okay, and here's my question. Here's David's question. How much are corporations or, you know, chambers of commerce and so forth, spending on their side?
You know, I have no idea what the total expenditures are, but I can tell you that corporations spend a far, far smaller share of their revenue on politics than unions do. Unions spend a comparatively huge share of the revenue on politics, and in general, in battles over right to work, there's no doubt about the fact that in Oklahoma, when the right to work law came up for a referendum in 2001, that the organized labor side outspent the pro-right to work side.
Okay, Gordon, money, and right. Then back to our callers.
Okay, first of all, I think it's important to be clear what I said before. Under federal law, every worker in America can already say to their union, I don't want to give any dues towards politics. So there's no such thing as forced dues that go to politics. That's already in federal law. I do think, and this kind of gets back to something that you said later, which is, you know, why is this such a big deal politically, that from the point of view of the business lobbies, of some of the corporate lobbies, the Chamber of Commerce, the more right-wing business lobbies, Americans for Prosperity, they look at the labor movement as their main opposition on a whole range of issues that are not labor-specific. They want a lower minimum wage. The labor movement wants a higher minimum wage. Labor movement generally wants to be able to import cheaper drugs from Canada, and they're against it. They want more NAFTA-style free trade treaties, and the labor movement is the opponent of that. And I think what they think is, if we can make unions financially unviable, we'll have a free hand to remake the economy at our will in all these other ways. And I think that's why it's been such a big issue for the business lobbies, and why they continue to push it in places like Indiana and New Hampshire, where it's been kind of politically ugly.
All right, let's take one more call if we could. Paul's waiting in Bedford. Hey, Paul, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'll be real quick. I see you're running out of time. I was just wondering, in all fairness, if there shouldn't be some movement towards a right to run a business law, in which local business owners would have the right to join the local chamber of commerce, but not pay any dues to the local chamber of commerce, and just sit around and reap whatever benefits that might come from membership in, but not paying dues to the chamber of commerce. I think it'd be a great idea.
Are you being a little sarcastic there, Paul?
Well, perhaps I think so. I will. I think you take my meaning, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. So not fair to reap the benefits, you know, if you're not paying in. Go ahead, Gordon.
I don't think it's a sarcastic thing, because I think what's happening here is that the corporate lobbies want unions to operate under rules that they don't accept for themselves. And this came up in Indiana because, again, by federal law, a union is required to provide all services for free to anybody in the workplace, even if they're not a member and not dues paying. When the Chamber of Commerce was asked, would you agree to provide all your services to any business that wanted without paying dues, they said no, because we would go out of existence. Well, that I understand that. That's logical. But that is their agenda for unions.
Stan, I hear you want to jump in. And Mark, I haven't forgotten about you. I got a question for you, too. But go ahead, Stan. Jump in on Paul's point, please.
Of course, what Gordon is referring to is a privilege, not a burden, of unions. The power to negotiate wages and benefits for employees who don't want to join the union and would prefer to negotiate their wages and benefits for themselves. Of course, the Chamber of Commerce does not purport to speak for all businesses. And if a business wants to hire its own lobbyist or the business owner wants to testify himself before the legislature to represent his business's interests, the Chamber of Commerce can't stop him from doing that. But a union can stop an employee from representing himself. What Gordon Lafer and the caller also assume is that all workers who are unionized benefit from unionization. And yet pro-union spokesmen themselves acknowledge outside the context of debates over right to work that that's not true. And I'll quote somebody from the Economic Policy Institute, the organization that Dr. Lafer kindly represents for free because he agrees with its perspective. Richard Rothstein, a fellow with the API for a long time, wrote a number of years ago that one typical impact of a union contract is raising pay of the less productive workers by, in part, reducing pay of the more productive workers. That's what Richard Rothstein wrote. The fact is that union contracts benefit some employees at the expense of others. Some employees, as Rothstein and even people like Richard Freeman, who's the most prominent proponent of organized labor in academia in this country, they acknowledge some workers, a substantial share of them, get paid less as a result of being unionized. And yet Gordon Lafer wants to force them to pay dues, too.
Okay, Gordon, that's a direct point, so I need to give you a quick chance to respond,
thanks.
And then Mark Guan, I want to finish out with you.
Unions are democratic organizations within the workplace. It's just like being a citizen of a country. I'm lucky enough to have a 5-year-old girl who's in kindergarten right now, which means other people's taxes are paying for her school. And when I get to be older and she's out of the house, I'll be paying for other people's kids. So it's the same thing with a union. If enough people don't like it, they vote down the contract, they vote out the leadership, or they vote to get rid of the union. All those things are possible and easy to do under federal law and happen.
And Mark Guarino with you again, Christian Science Monitor reporter. You've been covering this issue in the Midwest. But your thoughts broadly, Mark, on where this debate's going to go, both in your region and nationally?
Well, that's again, I think that depends on what's happening politically. And I think this is a big year for determining that, because it's the national, you know, it's the election year. And
right.
I think that it's where it's really, I think, not necessarily the question of what's happening this year. You know, whether it's going to be pushed through this year is what happens after the election and how things play out. It wasn't by chance that after the November midterm elections from 2010 that you saw a lot of this type of legislation, not just right to work, but the attacks on collective bargaining issues, public sector unions, kind of starting to happen all over. And I think that what we see happening in the ballot box is going to affect how states all over the country are going to what the political agenda is, whether right to work will be, you know, on the top of that list.
So, Mark, any states in your area looking at it for this this half of the legislative session, or are you pretty much done for this time around, and you're waiting for the post 2012 election?
Right. Yeah, we're pretty much done. I mean, it's been talked about in Michigan, but the governor of Michigan just recently, literally about two, three weeks ago, came out and said, let's table that. And I think that was, in response to seeing of the real ugly battles he saw in his neighboring states.
Well, Mark, I'm going to cut you off there. Yeah. Sorry to cut you off there, Mark, but thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Mark Guarino, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, based in Chicago. Stan Greer, thank you very much for your time.
Glad to be with you.
Stan Greer, newsletter editor for the National Right to Work Committee. And Gordon Lafer, thank you very much for coming in, and welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you.
Gordon Lafer, associate professor at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Ryan Lessard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Canoy.